Chapter 17. In a remote, barren part of the Southwest Desert, a few kilometers east of Douglas, Arizona, and only 75 meters, 246 feet, from the border between Mexico and the United States, the Hacienda La Princesa loomed like a Moorish castle at an oasis. It was named by the original owner, Don Antonio Diaz, in honor of his wife, Sofia Magdalena, who died during childbirth and was entombed in an ornate Baroque crypt that stood enclosed within a high-walled garden. Diaz, a peon who became a miner, struck it rich and took an immense amount of silver out of the nearby Huachuca Mountains. The huge feudal estate rested on lands that were originally granted to Diaz by General, later President of Mexico, Antonio López de Santa Anna, for helping to finance the despot's campaigns to subdue Texas and later launch a war against the United States. This was a disaster that Santa Anna compounded by selling the Mesilla Valley in southern Arizona to the United States, a transaction known as the Gadsden Purchase. The border shift left Diaz's hacienda in a new country, a stone's throw from the old. The hacienda was passed down through the Diaz family until 1978, when the last surviving member, Maria Estala, sold it to a rich financier shortly before she died at 94. The new owner, Joseph Zolar, made no mystery of the fact that he acquired the hacienda as a retreat for entertaining celebrities, high government officials, and wealthy business leaders on a lavish scale. Zolar's hacienda quickly became known as the San Simeon of Arizona. His high-profile guests were flown or bused to the estate, and his parties were dutifully reported in all the gossip columns and photographed for the slick magazines around the country. An antiquarian and fanatical art collector, Zolar had amassed a vast accumulation of art objects and antiques, both good and bad. But every piece was certified by experts and government agents as having been legally sold from the country of origin and imported with the proper papers. He paid his taxes, his business dealings were above board, and he never allowed his guests to bring drugs into his home. No scandal had ever stained Joseph Zolar. He stood on a roof terrace amid a forest of potted plants and watched as a private jet touched down on the estate runway that stretched across the desert floor. The jet was painted a golden tan with a bright purple stripe running along its fuselage. Yellow letters on the stripe read, Zolar International. He watched as a man casually dressed in a flowered sport shirt and khaki shorts left the aircraft and settled in the seat of a waiting golf cart. The eyes below Zolar's surgically tightened lids glittered like gray crystal. The pinched, constantly flushed face complemented the thin, receding, brushed-back hair that was as dull red as Mexican saltillo tile. He was somewhere in his late 50s with a face that was fathomless, a face that had rarely been out of an executive office or a boardroom, a face that was tempered by hard decisions and cold from issuing death warrants when he felt they were required. The body was small, but hunched over like a vulture about to take wing. Dressed in a black silk jumpsuit, he wore the indifferent look of a Nazi concentration camp officer who considered death about as interesting as rain. Zolar waited at the top of the stairs as his guest climbed toward the terrace. They greeted each other warmly and embraced.
"Good to see you in one piece, Cyrus."
Saracen grinned.
"You don't know how close you came to losing a brother. Come along, I've held lunch for you."
Zolar led Saracen through the maze of potted plants to a lavishly set table beneath a palapa roof of palm fronds. "I've selected an excellent Chardonnay, and my chef has prepared a delicious braised pork loin." "Some day I'm going to pirate him away from you," said Saracen. "A fat chance," Zolar laughed. "I've spoiled him. He enjoys too many perks to jump ship." "I envy your lifestyle."
"And I yours."
"You've never lost your spirit of adventure. Always skirting death and capture by police in some desert or jungle, when you could conduct business out of a luxurious corporate office and delegate the dirty work to others." "A 9-to-5 existence was never in my blood," said Saracen. "I find wallowing in dirty dealings an exciting challenge. You should join me sometime."
"No, thank you. I prefer the comforts of civilization."
Saracen noticed a table with what looked like 4 weathered tree limbs about 1 meter in length lying across its surface. Intrigued, he walked over and studied them more closely. He recognized them as sun-bleached roots of cottonwood trees that had grown naturally into grotesque human-shaped figures, complete with torsos, arms and legs, and rounded heads. Faces were crudely carved in the heads and painted with childlike features.
"New acquisitions?" he asked.
"Very rare religious ceremonial idols belonging to an obscure tribe of Indians," answered Zolar.
"How did you come by them?"
"A pair of illegal artifact hunters found them in an ancient stone dwelling they discovered under the overhang of a cliff."
"Are they authentic?"
"Yes, indeed." Zolar took one of the idols and stood it on its feet. "To the Montolos, who live in the Sonoran Desert near the Colorado River, the idols represent the gods of the sun, moon, earth, and life-giving water. They were carved centuries ago and used in special ceremonies to mark the transition of boys and girls into young adulthood. The rite is full of mysticism and staged every 2 years. These idols are the very core of the Montolo religion."
"What do you estimate their worth?"
"Possibly $200,000 to the right collector."
"That much?" Zolar nodded.
"Providing the buyer doesn't know about the curse that stalks those who possess them."
Saracen laughed. "There is always a curse."
Zolar shrugged.
"Who can say?
I do have it on good authority that the 2 thieves have suffered a run of bad luck. One was killed in an auto accident, and the other has contracted some sort of incurable disease."
"And you believe that hokum?"
"I only believe in the finer things of life," said Zolar, taking his brother by the arm. "Come along. Lunch awaits." After the wine was poured by a serving lady, they clinked glasses, and Zolar nodded at Saracen. "So, brother, tell me about Peru." It always amused Saracen that their father had insisted on his sons and daughters adopting and legalizing different surnames. As the oldest, only Zolar bore the family name. The far-flung international trade empire that the senior Zolar had amassed before he died was divided equally between his 5 sons and 2 daughters. Each had become a corporate executive officer of either an art and antique gallery, an auction house, or an import-export firm. The family's seemingly separate operations were in reality one entity, a jointly owned conglomerate secretly known as the Sope Machaco. Unknown and unregistered with any international government financial agencies or stock markets, its managing director was Joseph Zolar in his role as family elder.
"Nothing short of a miracle that I was able to save most of the artifacts and successfully smuggle them out of the country after the blunders committed by our ignorant rabble, not to mention the intrusion by members of our own government."
"U.S. Customs or drug agents?" asked Zolar.
"Neither.
two engineers from the National Underwater and Marine Agency. They showed up out of nowhere when Juan Chaco sent out a distress call after Dr. Kelsey and her photographer became trapped in the sacred well. How did they cause problems? Saracen related the entire story from the murder of the true Dr. Miller by Amaru to the escape of Pitt and the others from the Valley of the Viracocha to the death of Juan Chaco. He finished by giving a rough tally of the artifacts he had salvaged from the valley and how he arranged to have the cache transported to Callao, then smuggled out of Peru in a secret cargo compartment inside an oil tanker owned by a subsidiary of Zolar International. It was one of two such ships used for the express purpose of slipping looted and stolen art in and out of foreign countries while transporting small shipments of crude oil. Zolar stared into the desert without seeing it. The Aztec Star. She is scheduled to reach San Francisco in 4 days.
That puts her in Brother Charles's sphere of activity.
Yes, Charles has arranged for your shipment to be transported to our distribution center in Galveston, where he will see to the restoration of the artifacts. Zolar held his glass up to be refilled. How is the wine?
A classic, answered Saracen, but a bit dry for my taste.
Perhaps you'd prefer a Sauvignon Blanc from Touraine. It has a pleasing fruitiness with a scent of herbs.
I never acquired your taste for fine wines, brother. I'll settle for a beer.
Zolar did not have to instruct his serving lady. She quietly left them and returned in minutes with an iced glass and a bottle of Coors beer.
A pity about Chaco, said Zolar. He was a loyal associate.
I had no choice. He was running scared after the fiasco in the Valley of Viracocha and made subtle threats to unveil the Sopema Chaco. It would not have been wise to allow him to fall into the hands of the Peruvian investigative police.
I trust your decisions, as I always have. But there is still Tupac Amaru. What is his situation?
He should have died, replied Saracen. Yet when I returned to the temple after the attack of our gun-happy mercenaries, I found him buried under a pile of rubble and still breathing. As soon as the artifacts were cleared out and loaded aboard three additional military helicopters, whose flight crews I was forced to buy off at a premium, I paid the local vaqueros to carry him to their village for care. He should be back on his feet in a few days.
You might have been wise to remove Amaru, too.
I considered it. But he knows nothing that could lead international investigators to our doorstep.
Would you like another serving of pork?
Yes, please.
Still, I don't like having a mad dog loose around the house.
Not to worry. Oddly, it was Chaco who gave me the idea of keeping Amaru on the payroll.
Why, so he can murder little old ladies whenever the mood strikes him?
Nothing so ludicrous. Saracen smiled. The man may well prove to be a valuable asset.
You mean as a hired killer?
I prefer to think of him as someone who eliminates obstacles. Let's face it, brother. I can't continue eliminating our enemies by myself without risk of eventual discovery and capture. The family should consider itself fortunate that I am the only one who has the capacity to kill if necessary. Amaru makes an ideal executioner. He enjoys it.
Just be sure you keep him on a strong leash when he's out of his cage.
Not to worry, said Saracen firmly.
Then he changed the subject.
Any buyers in mind for our Chachapoyan merchandise?
A drug dealer by the name of Pedro Vincente, replied Zolar. He hungers after anything that's pre-Columbian. He also pays a cash premium since it's a way for him to launder his drug profits. and you take the cash and use it to finance our underground art and artifact operations. An equitable arrangement for all concerned. How soon before you make the sale? I'll set up a meeting with Vincente right after Marta has your shipment cleaned up and ready for display. You should have your share of the profits within 10 days. Saracen nodded and gazed at the bubbles in his beer. I think you see through me, Joseph. I'm seriously considering retiring from the family business while I'm still healthy. Zolar looked at him with a shifty grin. You do, and you'll be throwing away $200 million. What are you talking about? Your share of the treasure. Saracen paused with a forkful of pork in front of his mouth. What treasure? You're the last of the family to learn what ultimate prize is within our grasp. I don't follow you. The object that will lead us to Waskar's treasure. Zolar looked at him slyly for a moment, then smiled. We have the golden bodysuit of Tiapoyo. The fork dropped to the plate as Saracen stared in total incredulity. You found Nimlop's mummy, encased in his suit of gold? It is actually in your hands? Our hands, little brother. One evening, while searching through our father's old business records, I came upon a ledger itemizing his clandestine transactions. It was he who masterminded the mummy's theft from the museum in Spain. The old fox, he never said a word. He considered it the highlight of his plundering career, but too hot a subject to reveal to his own family. How did you track it down? Father recorded the sale to a wealthy Sicilian mafioso. I sent our brother Charles to investigate, not expecting him to learn anything from a trail over 70 years old. Charles found the late mobster's villa and met with the son, who said his father had kept the mummy and its suit hidden away until he died in 1984, at the ripe old age of 97. The son then sold the mummy on the black market through his relatives in New York. The buyer was a rich junk dealer in Chicago by the name of Rummel. I'm surprised the son spoke to Charles. Mafia families are not noted for revealing their involvement with stolen goods. He not only spoke, said Zolar, but received our brother like a long-lost relative, and cooperated wholeheartedly by providing the name of the Chicago purchaser. I underestimated Charles, Saracen said, finishing off his final morsel of braised pork. I wasn't aware of his talent for obtaining information. A cash payment of $3 million helped immeasurably. Saracen frowned. A bit generous, weren't we? The suit can't be worth more than half that much to a collector with deep pockets who has to keep it hidden. Not at all. A cheap investment if the engraved images on the suit lead us to Oscar's golden chain. The ultimate prize, Saracen repeated his brother's phrase. No single treasure in world history can match its value. Dessert? Zolar asked. A slice of chocolate apricot tort? A very small slice and coffee, strong, answered Saracen. How much extra did it cost to buy the suit from the junk dealer? Zolar nodded, and again his serving lady silently complied. Not a cent. We stole it. As luck would have it, our brother Samuel in New York had sold Rummel most of his collection of illegal pre-Columbian antiquities and knew the location of the concealed gallery that held the suit. He and Charles worked together on the theft. I still can't believe it's in our hands. A near thing, too. Charles and Sam barely smuggled it from Rummel's penthouse before customs agents stormed the place. Do you think they were tipped off? Zolar shook his head. Not by anyone on our end. Our brothers got away clean. Where did they take it? Asked Saracen.
Zolar smiled, but not with his eyes.
Nowhere.
The mummy is still in the building. They rented an apartment 6 floors below Rummel and hid it there until we can safely move it to Galveston for a proper examination. Both Rummel and the customs agents think it was already smuggled out of the building by a moving van.
A nice touch.
But what happens now? The images engraved in the gold body casing have to be deciphered. Not a simple exercise. I've hired the finest authorities on Inca art to decode and interpret the glyphs. A husband and wife team. He's an anthropologist, and she's an archaeologist who excels as a decoding analyst with computers.
I should have known you'd cover every base, said Saracen, stirring his coffee.
But we'd better hope their version of the text is correct, or we'll be spending a lot of time and money chasing up and down Mexico after ghosts.
Time is on our side, Zolar assured him confidentially. Who but us could possibly have a clue to the treasure's burial site?